You missed the only funny part of the whole of the talk. Let me show you. Context is vital. That's what we were just spending the last 10 minutes on before you got to the recording. It's not just true in language, it's true in the Bible too. Let me give you one illustration before we get to Haggai. Turn with me to Mark chapter 15. If you've got a Bible, Mark chapter 15. I'll assume if you've got a paper copy, you will turn with me. I'll assume if you're doing something on a device, you are turning to it and not playing a game. But it's a free country, so do whatever you want. Mark chapter 15. Let me just read you three verses that come from Mark 15. And then we're going to do the interactive bit, where I'm going to ask you the questions, and you'll be able to answer them. They're not difficult. Let's pick it up from verse 33, Mark 15. At the sixth hour, darkness came over the whole world until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? When some of those standing near heard this, they said, listen, he's calling Elijah. One man ran, filled a sponge with wine vinegar, put it on a stick and offered it to Jesus to drink. Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down, he said. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus heard his cry and saw how he died, he said, surely this man was the Son of God. Here's the interactive bit. Imagine you're making a film of this part of Mark's Gospel. Where is the camera lens pointing in verse 37? What are we looking at? Jesus. Where? Oh, Jesus on the cross. Everyone happy with that? Verse 37 is Jesus on the cross, and particularly his death on the cross. It's the moment of his death. But where is the camera lens of Mark's action in verse 38, the very next verse? Where are we now? We're in the temple. So we've gone from outside the city of Jerusalem, now inside the city of Jerusalem. The location in the lens of Mark's action has suddenly changed. But where is the camera lens of Mark's action then in verse 39? Where are we looking now? We're back at the cross. Can you see that what Mark has done is told you about Jesus at the cross in verse 37, then told you about something that happened in the temple inside Jerusalem in verse 38, and then he tells you back at the cross, verse 39. And the question is, why do you think Mark does that? Why does Mark intersperse his account of the death of Jesus with this information about the curtain and the temple in Jerusalem? Why has he done it? Because they're related. Anyone want to unpack? Absolutely right. I'm not trying to trip anyone up. So there are no tricks, okay? Because they're related. You know, anyone think of in what way they're related? Okay. So what's happening at the temple is that the temple is being declared redundant as a special building where humans interact with the living God. Does anyone know what was inside that building that Mark's mentioning in verse 38? Yes, and that's behind what? You're right, behind the curtain. So this curtain separated the Ark of the Covenant, often called the Holy of Holies, or the Most Holy Place. Was anyone ever allowed to go into the Most Holy Place? The high priest. Any idea how often was he allowed to do it? You're firing on brilliantly. See? Once a year, the Day of Atonement. So on one day a year, one man was allowed behind this massive curtain into the place that signified God's presence amongst people. What would happen if anyone just walks into the Most Holy Place? They would die. Because sinful people can't encounter a holy God. What Mark's doing is telling you that the death of Jesus takes that barrier between sinful people and a holy God away and makes it possible for us by faith today to be in the presence of God and eternally one day to see him face to face. But I want you to notice how important the context of the whole Bible was to get to understand what Mark 15 and verse 38 is doing. Mark gives you no information about the temple at all. He just expects you to know it. Now, don't mishear me. It's not that you would understand nothing if you don't know the context of the whole Bible. My point is that the more you know of the whole, the better you'll understand any smaller part of it. Does that make sense? The more you understand of the context of the whole of the Bible, the better you'll understand the smaller parts of it. And on occasion, like here, and I haven't just chosen this passage randomly, we will get to why I've mentioned Mark 15 tomorrow. Mark just expects you to know. And if you didn't know all of the stuff which you helpfully have just told me about the temple and the high priest and the one day a year and the death, if you didn't know that, you cannot make sense of verse 38, other than say there is a connection between the death of Jesus and the curtain. You don't know what the connection is, and you don't know the significance of the connection. Mark just expects you to know. Well, what we're going to do from tomorrow is we're going to journey all the way through a little book in the Old Testament called Haggai. I wonder whether you could turn to it. No, that isn't a... I wonder whether you will turn to it. If you don't know where it is, there's no prizes for knowing. If you don't know where it is, there's a contents page at the front of the Bible. It will tell you, for example, that Haggai is the third to last book of the Old Testament. If you want, you can do the backflip method. Do you know the backflip method where you just kind of start flipping backwards and hope your eye alights on the one page, and hey presto, it did, on the one page that Haggai gets in the Old Testament. I want to read to you verse 1. In the second year of King Darius, on the first day of the sixth month, the word of the Lord came through the prophet Haggai to Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest. That is the context into which Haggai is going to speak. We'll see that he speaks on four dated occasions. Here's the first, the second year of King Darius, the first year of the sixth, first day of the sixth month. Now, to understand the significance of verse 1, in this session, what we're going to very quickly do is get a bird's eye view of the whole of the Old Testament story up to this point. Now, I don't know how much you know. Do you know that the Old Testament and the New Testament are the two big sections of the Bible? The Old Testament, it just means covenant, deals with material before the coming of Jesus, and the New Testament, New Covenant, after the coming of Jesus. There are 66 books in our Bible. 39 are in the Old Covenant, Old Testament. 27 are in the New Testament, the New Covenant. Of those 39 books, we could broadly split the Old Testament into two halves. The first half of the Old Testament is Genesis 1 to 11. And the second half of the Old Testament is Genesis chapter 12 to the end of Malachi. They're not even in terms of space, but they are the two halves of the Old Testament. Broadly speaking, Genesis 1 to 11 is God's dealings with Adam and his family. And broadly speaking, Genesis 12, right to the end of the Old Testament, is God's dealings with a man called Abraham and his family, which of course becomes Israel. There's a lot of overlap in how God deals with Adam and his family and how God deals with Abraham and his family. Let's go right to the beginning of the second half of the Old Testament. The references are down there for you. We're going to look at, very briefly, at promises God makes to Abraham and then to David. Genesis 12. We've been following the line of Adam right the way down, through Noah, through Noah's three sons, and by the end of chapter 11, we come to this man, Abraham. He later becomes Abraham. We come to Abraham, and it looks a very odd thing indeed. because God is just about to choose the most unlikely person to bring about his purposes in the world. Look at what he promises. Chapter 12, verse 1. The Lord said to Abraham, "Leave your country, your people, your father's household. Go to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you I will curse, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." You can spot the repeated words, can you? I will. That is, it's a promise that God is making. God is making a promise to Abraham, and through him, second big repeated word, to bless. That is the opposite of the word curse, which is what happens as a result of Adam and Eve's rebellion in the garden at Genesis 3. So look in Genesis 3, the repeated word is curse. Here at the beginning of Genesis 12, the repeated word is bless. And God is going to undo through Abraham and through his descendants, God is going to undo the impact of what happened through Adam and Eve in Genesis 3. Notice that this is a promise. It's not a deal. This is unconditional. God's saying, I will do it. I will do it. I will do it. This is what he's going to do. And if you were only going to remember, apart from Haggai, of course, if you were only going to remember a handful of chapters in the Old Testament, Genesis 12 ought to be one of them. Because this is the pattern of the rest of the whole of human history. This is what God is doing through the rest of the Bible. This is what God is doing through the rest of human time, fulfilling this promise. So it's a biggie. The other biggie is a promise that God makes to a descendant of Abraham, to a man called David. And if I had to remember only a couple of chapters of the Old Testament, well, Genesis 12 would be one, and 2 Samuel 7. We have just skipped on hundreds of years to 2 Samuel 7, and God makes, again, some unconditional promises about a descendant of David. A descendant of Abraham, a descendant of David. At the little background going on at the beginning of 2 Samuel 7 is that David has become king over Abraham's descendants, the Israelites. David is their second king. The first was Saul. Here's the second, David. David has established Jerusalem as the capital city of the Israelites. And up until that moment, the presence of God that we were thinking about just now, the presence of God was residing in a tent. And it went wherever God's people went. David wants to build something more permanent. And so here he says in 2 Samuel 7, verse 2, "Here I am, living in a palace of cedar, while the ark of God remains in a tent." So David decides that it would be a good idea for him to build a temple, a more permanent place than a tent, for the presence of God. It would symbolize that God is with Israel. But Nathan, who's a prophet of God, is told in the night, no, it's not going to be David who is going to do this. No, it will be a son of David. So there will be a descendant of David who will rule on the throne, rule over a throne that is going to be a kingdom that is established forever. You can see, for example, in verse 11 through to 13, about this son of David, this descendant of David, one will come from your own body. I will establish his kingdom. He's the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Notice he'll not only be son of David, a descendant of David, then notice verse 14, God says, I will be his father, and he will be my son. Again, this is an unconditional promise. This is what God's going to do. He's going to establish a kingdom ruled by a king that will last forever. It'll be a great kingdom. It'll be a kingdom that will be of justice, goodness, blessing. Once we've got those two kind of, what it was, pillars or markers in our mind, we've got a handle on everything the whole Bible is about. Well, how does it work out in the Old Testament, those two promises? Well, I've said in the handout there the ups and downs of Israel's experience. Well, mostly downs, actually. It all started as a bit of a downer, actually, because when God made the promise to Abraham, it was the most unlikely person to make a promise to. Him having a descendant through whom the world would be blessed. Him having a descendant, at the end of Genesis 11, you're told as you go through the genealogy all the way down to Abraham, he's married to a woman called Sarai. My NIV translates it, she was barren. It literally translates the Hebrew, her womb was dead. Not an unlikely candidate. But that's who God chooses. By the end of Abraham's life, well, the whole world? No, Abraham's got a handful of children, and only one through whom the promise will be delivered. By the end of the book of Genesis, that number increases, and it gets as many as 70, which is still a bit of a down. Actually, you might say, well, that's pretty good, get 70 descendants. But God said, you'll have as many descendants as there is dust on the ground, or stars in the sky, or grains of sand on the seashore. When it comes to tomorrow afternoon, I see on the programme there's free time. If you want an activity, Hamish, you could give everybody a bucket and spade and send them out to the beach there. You need to go slightly to the right to actually get away from the pebbles, but it's gorgeous golden sand. I suggest, because we've only got 2 hours for free time, we all have one bucket each. And I suggest we bring the bucket back. No, probably not. Find a little space on the pavement, tip the sand out, and start counting the grains that are in the bucket. The promise is breathtaking. It moves to 70. But the promise to Abraham was of a people who would live in a land. And by the end of Genesis, a famine has come on the land, and the people can no longer live in that land. And they go and live in Egypt, where they become slaves. God rescues them from slavery in Egypt through a man called Moses. And they are rescued out of the harsh slavery and come eventually to the land that God had promised Abraham. But when the people came to the land, they didn't obey God properly. They didn't take the land completely. They didn't defeat the rebellious nations who were living in the land. God had always warned, if you disobey me, I'll throw you out of the land again. Just as Adam and Eve were thrown out of the garden. So something similar would happen to Israel again if she disobeyed. And right from the very start of her going into the land, Israel disobeys. Disobeys, disobeys. The thing that you would expect to happen, of course, is for them to get thrown out straight away. Adam and Eve were thrown out of the garden straight away when they rebelled against God and ate the fruit. But God is patient. And part of the remarkable story of the Old Testament is that God delays doing that and delays doing that and delays doing that and delays doing that. The people in the land are disobedient. God keeps raising up judges who deliver them from their enemies that they have been handed over to. 12 judges in the book of Judges that lead God's people. And then, just before our 2 Samuel 7 passage, in 1 Samuel 8, the people say to the last, really, of the judges, Samuel, "We'd like to have a king rule over us, so that we can be like all the other nations." It's the ultimate expression of worldliness, isn't it? We want to be like everybody else. Rejecting God who had led them brilliantly, they wanted a king like all the other nations have. In fact, read it and it sounds a bit like a pathetic child just before Christmas saying, "I want to have that new toy because that's what all my friends at school have got." It's really rather pathetic. But that just shows you how rebellious Israel are. Saul was the first king. David, as we've seen, was the second king. And the third king of Israel is introduced to us at the beginning of 1 Kings, and he's a man called Solomon. Now, Solomon disobeyed God in every way a king should. God had always known that Israel were going to have a king. In fact, God always knew they were going to ask for a king. In fact, God always knew that they wanted a king so that they would be like the nations. So, back in Deuteronomy 17, God had given 4 rules for a king to obey. Not many, is it? 4 rules for a king to obey. And read 1 Kings, chapters 3 to 11, and you discover what? Solomon breaks all 4 of them. The rules, well, if you know the story of the Old Testament, you may know them. The first rule that a king was not to disobey was that they must make sure that Israel always has an Israelite ruling over them. Deuteronomy 17. Guess what Solomon did? He gave 20 cities of the north away to the pagan king Hiram, king of Tyre. Second rule that the law, the Deuteronomy 17 passage had for the king was, you mustn't, if you're king, you mustn't acquire many horses. Guess what Solomon did? He built whole cities for his horses. Indeed, we're told that he had spectacularly, in 1 Kings 10, he had 12,000 horses. If you're a keen rider, having a couple might be okay, but 12,000 is a little on the excessive side. Third rule for a king, Deuteronomy 17, he mustn't acquire much gold. But 1 Kings 10 tells me that the weight of gold that Solomon received yearly was 666 talents. I've got a footnote in my Bible that tells me that that is about 16 tons. I Wikipedia'd, so who knows whether it's true, I Wikipedia'd how much gold there is in the Bank of England. About a tenth of what Solomon got every year. This man was seriously loaded. But he wasn't meant to have much gold. The fourth rule, and the one that perhaps he's best known for breaking, was that he mustn't have foreign wives. And you know what Solomon did? Well, 1 Kings 11, Solomon loved many foreign women. It had all started when he married Pharaoh's daughter in 1 Kings 3, but then he married Moabite women, Ammonite women, Edomite women, Sidonians and Hittites. They were from the nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, "You must not intermarry with them because they'll turn your heart after their gods." Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. Here's the breathtaking verse. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 porcupines. Sorry, concubines. They're just another word for prostitute. 700 royal wives. If I'd lived in that day, I reckon I'd have got into the wedding dress business. Or I might have become a royal photographer for Hello magazine. I don't know how you plan 700 weddings. When Joe and I got married, July the 13th, that's impressive, July the 13th, I know the date, we got engaged. We didn't go out at all. I just proposed. She said, well, you better do it more romantically than just asking me to marry you. So 3 weeks later, I did it the romantic way over a nice meal with the... Well, I haven't got the confidence to buy an engagement ring, so I bought some lovely drop earrings. They've got the glass-looking ones around the outside and the blue-looking ones. Whatever they are, are they emeralds, sapphires, rubies? Well, the blue ones are... Yeah, where well, she's got... And she's so scared that she'll lose them, she never wears them. But anyway, that's what I got her. I proposed to her, and I said, I'd like us to get married as soon as we practically can. She said it'll take 6 months to plan the wedding. 6 months. Well, Solomon couldn't afford 6 months for every royal wedding, could he? Because if it took 6 months, that would be 350 years to get the 700 weddings in. It's obscene, isn't it? And although we smile at it, listen to what the consequence was. As Solomon grew older, his wives turned his heart after other gods. And now we see the beginnings of God's patience wearing out. After Solomon's death, the kingdom splits into two. You can read it in 1 Kings 11 and 12. It's a mixture of disobedience against God again by the two men who become kings, and a bit of political intrigue as well. The northern area keeps the name Israel. The southern area takes the name Judah. The northern kingdom is huge. The southern kingdom has got two of the 12 tribes that there were in Israel and is very small in comparison. You then keep reading what happens in the north and the south. It all starts awfully in the north, because the first king of the north is a chap called Jeroboam, son of Nebat, and he builds two golden calves and says to the people, with an echo of what people had done centuries before in the day of Moses and Aaron. Jeroboam said, these are your gods who led you up out of slavery. Two golden calves. And what had Jeroboam done was he'd institutionalized idolatry as the national religion of the north. People were not allowed to go down south to Jerusalem, the previous capital city. They weren't allowed to go down to the temple to offer sacrifices. They were to be done at the golden calves. And every king of the north, there are 14 of them, every king of the north is a Torag who follows the same sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat. The south has got one or two better kings. But in the end, what happened to Adam and Eve, exiled from the garden? What was warned would happen to the Israelites happens. In 2 Kings 17, the Assyrians, who were the mighty superpower of the day, came and beat up the northern kingdom. The northern kingdom was meant to pay protection racket to the ruler of the Assyrians, meant to give him gold every year and then he wouldn't come and attack. Hoshea, who was the last king of the north, decided he wouldn't pay the yearly tribute, the yearly payment protection, the yearly insurance money. And in fact, he tried to make an alliance with the king of Egypt. So, Shalmaneser, the king of the Assyrians, came and besieged the northern kingdom and exiled the people. Ethnically cleansed the whole of the northern kingdom. And not only that, but repopulated the northern kingdom with all kinds of other people. And that was the end of the northern kingdom physically. Gone. The southern kingdom, Judah, lasted a little bit longer, one or two better kings. But in the end, what happened to the north is what happened to the south. And because of disobedience against God, the southern kingdom were also exiled, this time, it's 140 years later, by the new superpower, which was Babylon. And their king was a chap called Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was a military genius. If you want, you can go and see some of Nebuchadnezzar's relics, the things he had. He was a wealthy superpower of the superpower. You can go and see them. There's a large collection of them in the British Museum in London, and an even larger collection of them in the Louvre in Paris. And we in the French have got them because we just nicked it. Which is how we've got most of the stuff in our museums. We've just nicked it from other places. You can go and see how Nebuchadnezzar is described as a military genius. Because when he came and conquered Judah, he didn't just conquer that. He conquered pretty well all the known world. His problem was, how do you keep everywhere conquered? You need a very big army, don't you, to conquer the whole world and keep it conquered. That's what Adolf Hitler discovered in the Second World War. He goes and fights on the Western Front, goes and fights on the North African Front, then goes and tries the Ruskies on the Eastern Front, and in the end just hadn't got a big enough army to pull it off. You know what Nebuchadnezzar did? Military genius. When he exiled people from the Southern Kingdom, he exiled anyone who could lead a rebellion against him. We're told he deported 7,000 nobles. That may be a literal number or maybe figurative, 7, the complete 1,000 a lot. He deported 7,000 nobles. You'll know the story, perhaps, of some of them. People like Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And the book of Daniel tells you how God's people lived, carted off to Babylon. Now, Nebuchadnezzar's strategy was brilliant. He didn't just take everybody who could lead a rebellion against him to Babylon. That meant he didn't need to leave much of an army in Judah. He tried to turn the Israelites into Babylonians. He enrolled them for a 3-year state university course. Fully funded, by the way. No student loans. But God's promises to Abraham and to David, if God is going to be faithful, still had to be fulfilled. And at the end of 2 Kings, you are at the very bottom of the roller coaster of the story of the Old Testament. And yet God kept sending prophets who said, I will keep my promise, even though you're exiled. Jeremiah was told that the exile from Judah would last only 70 years. And so, after 70 years, guess what happened? A king called Cyrus, you can read about it in Ezra chapter 1, a king called Cyrus, he's king of Persia. Persia became the superpower after the Babylonians. And Cyrus writes and allows anyone who wants to return to Jerusalem. And 42,000 or so did. And we'll see what they had to do when they returned, because that's exactly where the book of Haggai fits in. But we must close by saying that the book of Haggai, therefore, needs to address and will address for us some unresolved questions or issues. The first is, will God truly keep his promises? You see, Ezra chapter 1, God's people are being ruled by this chap called Cyrus. But he's the king of Persia. He's not the descendant of David. In fact, although 42,000 people return from exile, we're going to discover tomorrow that nothing was like as it had been promised. And it raises the question, will God keep his promises? It raises the second question, when will God keep his promises? And thirdly, it raises the question, how will God keep his promises? You see, if God does not keep his promise, or only keeps one or two bits of his promise, then you and I have got a question mark about God's faithfulness. And if God is not faithful, that is, if God does not keep his promise, then can I say, give up being a Christian, and you might as well go home and not bother with the Beatles at all. If God doesn't keep his promise, you wouldn't know how to trust someone who doesn't keep their promise. As I said, I've been married to Jo for 26 years. She is the most remarkable woman I have ever met. I am more in love with her today than I was on the day we got married. I think she is the most stunning person imaginable. I can't believe that God quite ever trusted her into my husbandly hands. She is extraordinarily remarkable. If she had committed affair after affair after affair, do you think it would be easy for me to trust her in the future? When my father died, my mother felt able to tell all four of us as children her real life as his wife. He'd had at least six affairs that she knew about. And she said, I never could trust him. She said that he'd go away on a business trip and would be staying away overnight. She said, I had no idea whether he's in the arms of another woman. I could never trust him. And if God doesn't keep his promises, then you've got no reason to trust him either. And you might as well give up on that. Well, the book of Haggai is going to introduce us to how a faithful God chooses to use us to bring about his purposes in this world. And you know the irony is, he's the one who faithfully keeps his promise, and it's you and I who are the people who can't be trusted, because we do keep breaking ours. But nonetheless, God still chooses to use us. He'll use us to bring about the fulfillment of the promises to Abraham and the promises to David. And that's where the book of Haggai fits in.